Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Hillary, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, which is www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. For today's forum, it is Tunisia, the Arab Uprising, and the Implication for U.S. Policy in the Middle East. Today's guest is Ambassador Gordon Gray, former U.S. Ambassador of Tunisia. This event is co-sponsored by the Sam Rich Program and International Politics. Just a little bit more about our guest before he comes up. Ambassador Gray joined the faculty of the National War College in July 2012. He was the U.S. Ambassador of Tunisia from 2009 until 2012. Ambassador Gray's other foreign assignments include Egypt, Canada, Jordan, Pakistan, and Morocco, where he began his career in government as Peace Corps volunteer. Ambassador Gray holds a BA from Yale and an MA from Columbia, and is a member of the Middle East Institute in the American Foreign Service Association. In addition to spending time with his family, Ambassador Gray enjoys running, and he has run marathons, half marathons, in Europe, North Africa, and the United States. So please welcome me in giving a grand applause to our guest.
Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you for coming. I don't know if it's the subject matter or the free pizza, but both have a lot to say for themselves, I think. What I'd like to do today, if I could, is talk about the Arab Spring. But let me start out by saying just a little bit about this slide. This was taken in Tahrir Square, Cairo, at the time of the demonstrations against Mubarak. And this phrase, "people demand the removal of the regime," it actually sounds a lot snappier in Arabic than it does in English. But it started as a slogan that was chanted in Tunisia in the anti-Ben Ali protests. They chanted it in Cairo, as put it on their signs, as you can see. And they also... it was written on walls in Syria, in Daraa, where the first demonstrations began against Bashar al-Assad. I'm even told it was chanted during the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations as well. What I'd like to do this afternoon, is talk first about some of the contributing factors to the Arab Spring, then give you a bit of an analytical framework to consider different outcomes in different countries. And in so doing, I'll make a slight digression, or detour rather, to Tunisia and talk specifically about the Tunisian revolution. In looking at the revolutions throughout the Arab world, there have been a number of different variables which I'd like to talk about. There's still, as you can imagine, a great number of unresolved issues. And then finally, I'll talk briefly about some of the implications for the United States. Let me first talk about the terminology I'm using. I'm using the term Arab Spring to describe everything that happened. That's an imperfect term. It didn't start in the spring. It's gone through all four seasons. Some people use the term Arab uprisings. Others use the term Arab awakening. I don't really like those terms because there's a certain suggestion that there haven't been Arab uprisings or an Arab awakening before. I also like the connotation of hope that Arab Spring gives. But as I said, there's no one best term to use. Let me turn, if I may, to some of the contributing factors to what happened throughout the Arab world. The first is the profound sense of alienation and the lack of really development of civil society. And I think this quotation from a book written 20 years ago describes the very real frustration that people felt throughout the Arab world. And I think that contributed to one of the factors that led to the Arab Spring. As second factor contributing to the protests was the freer flow of information. And try as they might, the authoritarian regimes could no longer have a monopoly on what their citizens learned. I can give you a few examples from Tunisia. One was that of the scope of the censorship and kind of the ridiculous lengths to which people went to constrict the internet. The Al Jazeera website, for example, was blocked, but you could see Al Jazeera on satellite television. Facebook was not blocked in Tunisia. This is a sign from a picture from Egypt, again from Tahrir Square, where the sign says the young people of Egypt want to give you thanks, Facebook. In Tunisia, it was not blocked. It was the one source of the media that was social media that was open and available. The story I heard when I got to Tunisia, and this falls into the category of stories that are too good to be true, so I doubt it is true, but it's a good story anyway, is that the Ben Ali regime did block the internet. Facebook. Ben Ali's granddaughter came to see him with tears streaming down her face, saying, "Papa, you can't block Facebook. It's too important." And so he very magnanimously unblocked Facebook. Again, I don't know if it's true or not. I also wonder if it is true how that granddaughter is now treated in the family. But it was used extensively in Tunisia and elsewhere. Twitter was not a major factor in the demonstrations in Tunisia, but it has been very effective in mobilizing people in, for example, in Tehran. Now, that was not an Arab country, and that was pre-Arab Spring, but in Tehran in June 2009, protests against the rigged elections in the last presidential contest. And also very effective in mobilizing people in Cairo during the demonstrations, there. A third contributing factor was the youth bulge, which exists throughout the Middle East, and it's a real recipe for unrest, particularly during economic hard times. If you take a look at this chart, you'll see on the far right that the percentage of the population under the age of 25 in the UK is just 31%, but then for some of the select group of other countries, it ranges from 42% in Tunisia, as high as 65% in Yemen. El General is a Tunisian rap star. And he was arrested during the protests, during the revolution, and he was released before too long. But again, it shows the extent to which the youth were involved in the protests in Tunisia and elsewhere. Fourth contributing factor is the very pervasive corruption in many of these countries. It was particularly egregious and went past the level of acceptability, if you will, for corruption. I'll give you a few examples from Tunisia. This is a photograph of Ben Ali's son-in-law, Sahar El-Matri. He was 29 by the time the revolution began, and even though he was just 29, he already had major interests in automobile distributorships, and he owned the largest publishing house in Tunisia, which meant he controlled the largest circulation French newspaper, the largest circulation Arabic newspaper. He had interests in radio stations. So he really had extensive presence in the commercial sector. Obviously, a presence that he got because of the fact that his father-in-law was the president of the company. So there's a lesson there, I guess. Marry well. or maybe not, since he's now in exile. This is a picture of another Ben Ali relative. In this case, it's the nephew of his wife. And he was not as clever as his relative Sahar El-Matri. He was he did not leave Tunisia in time, and is in prison now. And I think he's going to be spending a long time in the future in prison. The Tunisian Revolution, relatively speaking, was not particularly violent. The UN estimates maybe 300 people lost their lives. And while any loss of life is regrettable, obviously 300 deaths pales by comparison to what we've seen in Syria, where the UN estimates already over 100,000 people have died. But there was a great deal of anger because of the corruption against against Ben Ali's family. And the Tunisians very carefully targeted family properties. This is a picture of what used to be Trabelsi's villa, and it was looted, burned out. Houses on either side weren't, but you'll notice all the spray painting, and that was after the fact. Teenagers who wanted to feel that, wanted to show their revolutionary zeal, would go to the house, spray paint graffiti, take a picture in front of it, post on their Facebook. The Facebook page. Not all of these four factors that I've laid out, I think, were contributing factors, but the best explanation I heard was from a member of why the Arab Spring began and why it happened in Tunisia, was from a member of civil society who was opposed to the regime. After Ben Ali fled, he became a member of the National Unity Government. And his explanation was that poverty and unemployment exist everywhere. This happened because of a loss of dignity and a lack of dialogue. And that really rings true to me. And I think it's applicable not only to what we saw happen in Tunisia, but throughout the Arab Spring as well. And if there's one slide that you remember, I commend this slide to you. Let me move on then, if I may, to framing the Arab Spring and giving you a bit of an analytical framework. And I'd even though each country has its own has seen its own developments, I'd break the outcomes that we've seen into four different groups. The first group is what I would call fleeing dictators. Dégage is French slang for scram or get out of here, and it's what the Tunisians chanted during their demonstrations. And even though Egypt isn't a Francophone country, the chant spread to some of the demonstrations in Cairo as well. And it... the revolution in Tunisia began when Mohamed Bouazizi, who was an underemployed university graduate, fruit and vegetable vendor, was approached by a policewoman, asked for his permit, she didn't have. She slapped his face and confiscated his fruit and vegetable cart, depriving him of his livelihood. And he understandably took umbrage at this, went down to City Hall to voice his grievances, and no one would listen to him. He was just a fruit and vegetable vendor. As a result, he set himself on fire, and this in turn led to the demonstrations in Tunisia, which started in the interior of the country and slowly spread. This is a picture of Ben Ali. He's here on your left, visiting Bouazizi in the hospital. This picture was on the front pages of all the newspapers, which were government controlled. So the government told them to put this on the front pages. This was a real sign to us that the regime perceived itself to be in trouble, because the idea of an authoritarian ruler deigning to visit one of his subjects in the hospital was a real reversal of what the norms were. And this next slide is a political cartoon that I think very, very nicely encompasses the chain of events. You have Bouazizi after his self-immolation, his fruit and vegetable cart knocking Ben Ali off his throne, but the scales which he uses to weigh his fruits and vegetables, I think there's also the connotation of the scales of justice. So in this category, I would put both Tunisia and Egypt. Similarities are both countries were republics. They both leaders, Ben Ali and Mubarak, fled after a relatively short time. In the case of Ben Ali, 4 weeks after the demonstrations started. Excuse me. In the case of Mubarak, it was 18 days. There've been elections in both countries, and relatively speaking, both societies are relatively homogeneous society. Let me expand a little on the Tunisian Revolution, which I think is we can call the first postmodern revolution, and I'll get back to the analytical framework for looking at the other outcomes in just a second. The reason I'd say that Tunisia can be considered the first postmodern revolution is that it wasn't an ideological revolution. People were insisting on values, human rights, transparency, but they weren't pushing Islamism or communism or nationalism or whatever. As a result, that allowed greater scope for cooperation among groups within society after the revolution. Second, it was a grassroots revolution. There really weren't any leaders to it, and that also meant that no single group could claim ownership of the revolution and thereby gain either legitimacy or greater amount of support. We talked about social media being important, and I think unlike a lot of previous revolutions we've seen, social media played a very important role. And fourth, and very interestingly, it was a revolution which participants didn't seek to take power. They wanted to get rid of the Ben Ali regime and the Ben Ali family. They succeeded in doing it, but their primary goal was not to try and put themselves into power. So continuing with framing the Arab Spring and giving you a bit of an analytical framework, talked about fleeing dictators as a group. The second group of republics were those where the authoritarian rulers did not depart the scene, unfortunately, and the countries degenerated or disintegrated into civil war. Syria is perhaps the most obvious example of that that continues to this day. Libya is another example. Yemen would be a third example. And in the case of Libya and Yemen, they were very heterogeneous societies, unlike Tunisian Egypt, great tribal divisions. In the case of Syria, you have a minority group, the Alawites, which are about 12% of the population, ruling over the rest of the country. The third group, analytically, would be those countries which have succeeded in managing change from above. The three countries I'd put in this category would be Algeria, Morocco, and Jordan. In the case of Algeria, demonstrations broke out shortly after the demonstrations in Tunisia, but the Algerians have very robust security forces, and those they interceded quickly. They also have a great deal of financial resources because of their energy exports, and they were able to throw a lot of money at the problem. In the case of the cases of Morocco and Jordan are slightly different. They don't have the resources, the financial resources that Algeria does, but in each case, the kings can claim a certain amount of religious legitimacy because of their descendants of the Prophet. In the case of King Mohammed of Morocco, I would say he was ahead of the reform curve. He succeeded his father in 1999 and instituted basically a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look into some of the human rights abuses that happened during his father's reign. He also expanded the rights of women. And following the Arab Spring, demonstrations, which Morocco saw, he instituted a number of constitutional reforms, which led to the election of which led to new elections and the installation of a government headed by an Islamist party, including an Islamist prime minister. In the case of Jordan, I think that King Abdullah has also been able thus far to ride out some of the protests that we've seen there. Those protests seem to have tapered off. He also instituted a number of constitutional reforms. And again, I'd say his situation is a little bit more precarious than that of King Mohammed, but certainly not, like I said, he seems to be weathering the storm. The fourth and final category of countries are the Gulf monarchies. And with the exception of Bahrain, which I'll get to in a moment, they've been fairly successful in dealing with the Arab Spring. There were demonstrations in Kuwait, but Kuwait has a very active parliament, has had it since long before the Arab Spring began, and these demonstrations, I think, were more a result of differences between the parliament and the ruling family than they were because of the Arab Spring. There were demonstrations as well in Saudi Arabia's eastern provinces, which were predominantly Shia in nature, but Bahrain was the country that saw of the Gulf monarchies. It was the country that saw the most widespread demonstrations. I think the reason for that is clear. The Bahrain has a ruling Sunni minority with a majority Shia population, and so there have been tensions throughout its history. There have been demonstrations before. This is a picture of demonstrations in Pearl Roundabout, which was kind of the Bahraini equivalent, if you will, of Cairo's Tahrir Square, as kind of the central gathering place. And the Bahraini government responded by tearing down the monument and blocking off the square so that no one could protest there. Let me move on to some of the different variables in looking at how countries have responded to the Arab Spring. I'd give you five variables to consider. First is the nature of the society. As I mentioned, Tunisia and Egypt tend to be fairly homogeneous societies. Contrast that with some of the tribal divisions in countries like Libya or Yemen, or the sectarian divisions in countries like Syria and Bahrain. I would also say that in the case of countries like Tunisia and Egypt, there's very much a sense of nationhood and nationality. Second variable is the role of the military. And in some places, the military has played a very apolitical role. This is a photograph of the then chief of defense staff of the Tunisian Armed Forces, General Ammar. The Tunisian Armed Forces refused to fire on Tunisian civilians, and actually, since they were untarnished by any human rights abuses, when they moved in to establish order following Ben Ali's departure, they were really welcomed by the Tunisian population. This is a photograph taken by a journalist. It's not a propaganda photograph by the Tunisian army or anything. And I saw people going up to tanks in the streets and putting bouquets of flowers on them because the people were pleased to see pleased with the role of the Tunisian military police to see that they were restoring order. You know, compare that to, say, the Libyan military, which was a mercenary force, felt no compunction about firing on Libyan citizens, or what we're seeing today in Syria. A third factor to consider is leadership. People matter. In the case of Tunisia, Ben Ali left 4 weeks after the demonstrations began. As I said, Mubarak left the scene 18 days afterwards, and they both spared their country a lot of violence. Just as an aside, if you look at this picture, you'll see Ben Ali with his hand over his heart. What the Tunisians always said was, what he was actually saying was, "I know where your money is. It's right here in my wallet." And that was the level of their concern about how much corruption there was. But compare Ben Ali and Mubarak in their early departure with, say, a situation such as Libya, where Gaddafi literally fought to the end, or Bashar in Syria, where he is apparently fighting to the end as well, unfortunately. A fourth factor is the level of resources that a country has. I mentioned the financial resources of Algeria. Saudi Arabia greatly increased its subventions to its population following the Arab Spring demonstrations. And this is an option that obviously not all countries have. Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen, which is a very poor country, did not have the same tools in his toolkit. A fifth and final variable is either the regional or the international reaction. And in that respect, I would note, say, case of Tunisia, where the United States was very quick to praise the revolution. And in particular, I'm thinking the president's State of the Union address on January 25th, 2011, just 11 days after Ben Ali fled. A lot of Tunisians said that gave them a great deal of confidence moving forward. But contrast that to, say, Bahrain, where Gulf Cooperation Council militaries rolled in to suppress the demonstrations to support the Bahraini monarchy. You can also contrast with the international community's reaction to the situation in Libya, where there was it started with the Gulf Cooperation Council with a call for action, moved to the Arab League, ultimately to the Security Council, and then there was a coalition that included not just NATO, but also United Arab Emirates and Qatari military as well in enforcing a no-fly zone in Libya. But that's far different from what we've seen in Syria. There are obviously a number of unresolved issues remain, and in all of these countries, a political scientist at George Mason University, writing, relatively speaking, just a few months after the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, cautioned people to wait and said, basically, these things take time. He said it takes half a decade for any type of stable regime to consolidate, and even that might be an optimistic estimate. But we need to remember that the process of democracy takes a certain amount of time, and it will take time for people for events to shake out. Let me give you a few examples, though, of some very serious issues that I think need to be resolved if the transitions are to be successful. One is freedom of expression and the role of the media. Persepolis is a Franco-Iranian animated film. Some of you may have seen it. The head, Nabil Karoui, was the head of a Pan-Maghreb satellite station based in Tunisia, aired it a couple of weeks before the revolution. And as a result, his house was firebombed, fortunately without any loss of life, by a group, kind of a mob of probably of Salafists. They were let off scot-free, and he was convicted of disturbing the public order and, very ironically, was sentenced on May 3rd of last year. May 3rd happens to be World Press Freedom Day. Freedom of expression is not just an issue in Tunisia. Some of you may have heard of Bassem Youssef. If any of you watch The Daily Show, he's been a guest on The Daily Show, and some Americans at least call him the Egyptian John Stewart, because his television show is also a satirical look at the news. He was charged with, although not convicted of, insulting then-President Morsi. So how societies deal with freedom of expression in general, and particularly with the with freedom of the media, is going to be extremely important in whether the transitions are successful. Another issue to be confronted is Salafist violence. In Tunisia, just over a year ago, Salafists attacked our embassy. Although about 20 were convicted, they were given suspended sentences. It's not just a question of attacking U.S. facilities. They've also gone destroyed a Sufi shrine. We've seen in Egypt many cases, unfortunately, where either Coptic Christians were either killed or their churches were burned down. And Salafist violence has included assassination of secular political leaders in Tunisia, both earlier this year. Both Shokri Belaid and Mohamed Brahimi were assassinated. And political assassination in Tunisia is very rare, so this is obviously a very troubling development. Another issue to be resolved is what are the relations going to be between the government and between the military? As I said, in Tunisia, the Tunisian military has played a very apolitical role, but In Egypt, we saw the military step in over the summer. And yet another issue to be resolved is the our economic issues. Sidi Bouzid is where Mohamed Bouazizi is from. These demonstrations came 2 years after, on the second year anniversary of his self-immolation, but they weren't political in nature, they were economic in nature. People wanted jobs, they wanted to know how the revolution was going to address their economic concerns. And for all of these countries, that remains an issue, particularly unemployment. And it's exacerbated by the not just the lack of stability, but also by unrealistic expectations, I think, by some of the citizens. In looking at the implications for the United States, I think it's important to bear in mind, while this matters to us a great deal because of the strategic importance of many of these countries, the Arab Spring was not primarily about us. We've seen lots of demonstrations over the years which were anti-U.S. in nature. This is, but the Arab Spring really didn't have that anti-American element to it. Is it going to make the conduct of foreign policy more difficult for us? Absolutely. There's no question about it. It's new situations, fluid situations are always more difficult to deal with. That being said, it also gives us a number of opportunities. Certainly looking at it from a Tunisian perspective, Ben Ali, who was hypersensitive about human rights issues given his poor record, was replaced by a human rights activist, Marzouki, who was far more sympathetic to our goals and aspirations in this regard. For example, he was the first Arab head of state to meet with Syrian opposition leaders. Also in Tunisia, we have far more opportunities now to engage with the Tunisian people than we did beforehand when under the Ben Ali regime, which was so discouraging of such contacts. I think in the long run, though, open economic systems, more transparent political systems are in our national interest. So I think there are definitely going to be bumps in the road, but I think that it will come out as a net gain for our interests. Let me just conclude by saying that if on January 1st, 2011, a speaker had come up here and predicted that from left to right, Ben Ali of Tunisia, Ali Abdullah Saleh of Yemen, Gaddafi of Libya, and Mubarak of Egypt would all be gone from the scene after something like 120 years of authoritarian rule among them. No one would have believed it. But they did leave the scene. As the sign says, it was game over for them. And I think that when we look back, when we have the benefit of a little more time, and we look back on the events of 2011, I think we'll conclude that they're just as important for the Arab world, just as much of a watershed as the events of 1989 were for Europe and in fact for the rest of the world. So let me I'll close with a verse from a probably the most popular and well-known Tunisian poet, well-known within Tunisia, which I think captures a bit of the spirit of the Arab Spring. And I'd welcome any comments you may have, any questions you may have. And in addition to answering any questions you may have about the Arab Spring, I'm also more than happy to address any questions you may have about careers in the Foreign Service. On the kind of the shelf back there, we've got a number of flyers on Foreign Service careers and on civil service careers, on internships in the State Department. So please feel free to pick up a flyer on your way out. But let me ask if you've got any questions.
I'm going to hand the mic to the people with questions, so just make sure you state your first and last name before you ask your question, please.
George Fifita. My question is, how is the U.S. presence in the Middle East Arab countries being felt?
Do you want to know what do you mean by the U.S. presence?
Yeah, like with their presence, government officials, or even Michael Jackson, even lived in Bahrain. How are they? My question is how are they being viewed?
Well, I think I would. You know, all things being considered, we don't have a particularly large footprint in most of these countries. I mean, the business communities, for example, the American business communities in the Middle East are much smaller than, say, they are in Europe or in Asia. That being, and we've obviously, with the removal of forces from Iraq, our military presence in the region, while not insignificant, is because we do have a number of military posted, particularly in the Gulf monarchies, but it's far less visible than it was before. But that being said, I think there's some American institutions which have a tremendous amount of weight and do a tremendous amount of good in the Middle East. They're not governmental institutions, but I'm thinking of the educational institutions. Perhaps the American University of Beirut is the most famous and arguably the most influential of these, but certainly American University of Cairo I would rank right up there. There's also kind of a new generation of American educational institutions that are being established in, particularly in Gulf countries, because they've got the resources, and perhaps those have the greatest potential for long-term improving relations, because you're getting people at a young age and giving them hopefully a good impression of the United States, not in a policy sense, but in a cultural sense, and just in that people-to-people connection that's so important.
Hi, I'm Ashley Madrigal, and I'm concerned for the United States' safety. We're seeing other countries having revolutions and problems with their government, and the U.S. often wants to save the world. And so do you think the U.S. should be worried about anti-U.S. sentiment, because we keep getting involved with other countries' affairs?
Well, I think that I'll give you Goldilocks answer to that question. I think that there's a great deal of sensitivity, particularly in the Middle East, to American military intervention. And, you know, historians will debate the Iraq War for years to come, but regardless of what one thinks about the wisdom of our military action, there's no question that it was tremendously unpopular in the Middle East. At the same time, I think that the United States has won itself a fair amount of goodwill through its support for revolution, say in Tunisia. And I think that there's always an appreciation for United States engagement on trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. So the reason I say it's a Goldilocks answer is their dangers to being overly involved. But at the same time, I think there'd be a real setbacks for our national interests if we were to withdraw from our engagement, both in terms of popular perception in the Middle East or elsewhere, but also because we've got interests abroad. And those interests are projecting our values. They're projecting open economic and democratic systems, not just because it makes us feel good to do so, but if there are open economic systems overseas, that means we can export our goods, and that's going to be better for people, better for our economy, and we know our economy needs the help.
My name is Robert Dixon. How has the, the track record of the United States with its military interventions in specifically Iraq, but also Afghanistan, affected the negotiations and the process that we've engaged in Syria? And do you think that if we hadn't involved in Iraq or Afghanistan, would Syria be as willing to comply with our demands or threats?
I wouldn't make a correlation, between our military engagement in either Iraq or Afghanistan and Syria's willingness to hand over its chemical weapons. I don't see that existing. I think there's only one possible conclusion about the president signaling his willingness to use force against Syria because of its use of chemical weapons on August 21st. To me, paraphrase Winston Churchill, that very much concentrated the Syrians' minds, and I think without that, they would not have been willing to relinquish their chemical weapons, and I believe similarly that the Russians would not have been willing to go along with any diplomatic effort to try and get them to relinquish their chemical weapons.
My name is Remington Carlson, and despite military actions in the Middle East, what is the general opinion of the Arab countries of the United States as a whole?
There are things about the United States which I think people in the Middle East find extremely appealing, and some of those would include our educational system, the fact that we have open societies, our culture. If you go to just about any embassy or consulate in U.S. embassy or U.S. consulate in the Middle East, you'll see very busy consular sections processing visas for people who want to travel to the United States. For many people who have the means to do so want to try and educate their children in the United States or do business in the United States, or they just want to come and visit because they've seen American films or read American books. So there's a great deal about America as a country, what we represent, what our values are, that appeals to many people in the Middle East. And also at the risk of sounding like I'm patting all of us on our backs, Americans are generally open people, and I think that's very appealing to people in the Middle East. There's a certain affinity in many cases. That being said, there are definitely policies of the United States that people in the Middle East, by and large, object to. And we talked about Iraq as one example. In many countries and for many publics, the U.S. support for Israel is highly unpopular. So there are many of our policies are popular, but at the same time, many of our policies are unpopular as well.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions. So if you want to help me with a hand for our Ambassador Gray.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.